Session number 24575.
Colonel Michael Dimitriade, Real One. And if I could ask you, first of all, to tell me something about your family background. Whereabouts were you born and raised? And I wondered if you would say something about your parents as well.
I was born in London on the 20th of October 1920. And my father and mother had married in India earlier on. I was born I've forgotten the name of the place, in Chelsea, more or less. My father was the fourth son of a large family. His two elder brothers and his sister had been born in India, where their father had moved from the Aegean area, really. He had been born in Kumaria, in the island of Tenos. And when his father was about four, or rather when he was about four, his father had died. And he married, his mother married again, and he took his stepfather's name and nationality of Dimitriade. Before that, the family name had really been Capello or Capelli from a very ancient Venetian family, which one of my father's brothers, an uncle Stephen, who was subsequently knighted towards the end of the 1418 war for dealing with services pensions and ex-service men's pensions. He researched the family history, and he produced a family tree which went back certainly to 880 in Venice, and the dotted line to 90 BC, which I don't think I could really credit. However, many of the family don't believe this story, but I do, and a number of my cousins do, not only the children of my uncle that I mentioned, but other cousins as well. And we don't see any reason why it should not be true. The only thing is we can't absolutely prove with documents that what would be my great-grandfather did in fact remarry, or rather when his mother remarried, that he took his stepfather's name and nationality. We have certain documents which indicate it, but we cannot prove it. That was a very mixed-up area of the world in those days, in the days of the Venetian Empire, and things were changing nationalities and allegiances all the time. Well, that was my father's family. My grandfather, my father's father, was actually born in, I said before, in Kumaria. He's actually born in Smyrna, and he was naturalised in British in Manchester on the 2nd of April 1885, and died later at Prestwich on the 25th of June 1908. Now, my mother's family is even more curious. Her grandfather was the son of Lady Eliza Erskine, who was the daughter, sister of the 27th Earl of Mar. Her father had been in India in the Indian Railways, met my father there when he was working in the textile trade. All the family at that time were associated with a firm in India called Raleigh Brothers, that's R-A-L-L-I Brothers, who dealt in cotton piece goods, trading into and out of Manchester to India. An amusing story is one of the ways that people used to mispronounce our name. I think the most extravagant one was Dammit Hardy rather than Dimitriade. But also, Raleigh Brothers was full of Greeks and ex-Greeks with names like Sotiades and things of that sort. And the story goes about one party at which a person was inquired after and was told that this man was in bed with peritonitis. Oh, they said, another of those damned Raleigh Brothers. So that's roughly my ancestry. Having been born in London, I went out to India with my parents when I was only a few months old. And we went to Karachi, where my father was working, and later moved to Calcutta, where he was the manager of Raleigh's interests there. And in 1928, he decided to retire at a very young age. And we came back to England and settled in London, firstly around the corner of the BBC, and then after a year or so in St. James' Court in Buckingham Gate in London, where we stayed really for the duration of the war, or very nearly so. I went to school, day schools in London, and then to a prep school in Hampshire, and finally to Radley, where I went in 1935, rather about a year older than my contemporaries, because I'd been put up to take a scholarship to Lancing, which I didn't succeed in getting. But I was admitted to Radley quite happily. And there I had a very happy time. I played music and I played games and I was captain of fencing and things of that sort. And I was also being a bit of a musician in the OTC band. In those days, the colleges had a very flourishing officers training corps, and ours is no exception. We were affiliated to the Oxford and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, although we wore our own specific uniforms with our own badges. And in the band, I eventually reached the dizzy ranks of bugle major. We called it bugle major because of the association with the light infantry. And afterwards, when I had left school and was negotiating to join the army, the school very kindly described me as being a warrant officer class 2, which is a little bit of exaggeration, but it helped, I suppose. However, I left school just before my 19th birthday in July 1939, when war was obviously imminent, and we'd had to carry gas masks at school, and we'd learnt about what to do in the case of air raids. And I immediately applied to join the Officer Cadet Reserve. However, I was told, I got a reply that that was full. They weren't taking any more. So I went off and enlisted in the Royal Fusiliers in London as a fusilier in the Territorial Army. Again, they couldn't cope with the number of people who were coming forward. One forgets sometimes that conscription actually was initiated before the start of the war, in April of 1939. And people were being called up compulsorily. National service, per contra, wasn't introduced until after the war, in 1945, to come into a force in 1947. But Field Marshal Montgomery, in his impatience as CIGS, couldn't wait for it to come into operation, and so he just extended conscription for 2 years. And people who did conscription, who were called up under conscription and national service at that time, could go on serving until 1960. And as they were doing a 2-year tour at that time, the last of the national service people would have served until the end of 1962, and then Britain had an all volunteer army. So,
before we go into your war experience, could I take you back to your boyhood in India? Mm. And did that make much of an impression on you? This would have been for 8 years, am I right in thinking that?
Yes.
Was that, you know, an important part of your life? Yes.
My boyhood in India was a strange one, in as much as I was an only child, and therefore very much, I suppose, not with my parents, but not awfully much with other young children. I was greatly spoiled by the Greek members of Raleigh Brothers, who, like all Greeks, were very lavish with their presents. But I had an English nanny and an Indian ayah. And my first reading lessons, I remember, were with my English nanny. Rupert the Bear, I seem to recall, was a great favourite. And of course, we lived in rather curious conditions in those days, and as much as we'd had no running water, no plumbing of any sort, we had a wet sweeper to empty our thunder boxes and so on. And we lived under mosquito nets. My father in Calcutta ran a very successful string of racehorses, and won practically every cup which was going there. Unfortunately, only one of them survives for me today. I suppose he won it outright, and the others had to be returned. But his stables was rather distinguished by the fact that all the horses' stalls had electric fans put in them to keep them cool in the hot weather. We had a wonderful butler whose name I've forgotten, but the under butler was given a watch by my father, which he broke. And when it was mended, I was given it to return to it to him. And I ran and tripped over, fell on the floor, and smashed it again. And the butler picked me up and said, "Never mind, Sal, he can't tell the time anyway."
Did you mix at all with the Indian children?
No, not at all. Not at all. We had two cars. My father and mother had a Minerva, and I had an old Woolsey, which I had with my nanny. And our driver always insisted upon wearing a solar topi rather than a cap, because he'd once been stoned by other Indians. But no, I didn't mix with any Indian children, or really with any Indians. I had one or two, but not many, European friends. I can't say why that was. It was just the way things worked out. In the hot weather from Calcutta, we used to go up to Simla. And my mother and I in particular, but my father did come too. And we stayed in a place called Corstorphine Hotel, which I remember, on a hill known as Jacko, which was covered in monkeys. And one had to keep screens on the windows of one's rooms to keep the monkeys out, otherwise they'd come in and pinch everything. And there again, we were rather distinguished by the fact everybody drove around in a rickshaw, which was a two-wheel vehicle, pulled by men, which accommodated one person. And we, I think, were the only people in Simla who had a double rickshaw, which had two sets of men, and carried my nanny and myself. There was the White Hart, the Black Hart Ball, I think it was, which was run by a local philanthropic company, which was a great occasion every year with fancy dress. And I remember being dressed up by mother as a Pierrot and a fencer and my goodness knows what else. I was also made a scout cub, because I never saw a scout troop. I don't think that really amounted to very much.
I suppose if you hadn't returned, if your parents hadn't returned in 1928, you might well have been separated from them for your education, because that would have been the norm then, wasn't it?
Absolutely, I'm sure that's what would have happened, but I don't know why my father decided to retire so early, particularly when the slump was coming in England, but that's what he did decide, and I would have thought in after years probably regretted it. It may have been partly on account of my mother, who was 12 years his junior, and had great acting aspirations. She'd done a lot in amateur theatricals in India. And when we returned to England, she actually went to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and subsequently did take part in a number of West End productions, including one with an actor called Godfrey Terrell in a play called The Island by an author called Dr. Merton Hodge. Thereafter, she went in for a series of plays at the Kew Theatre, with a man called Jack DeLion, and they had D&D productions, which was DeLion and Dimitriadi, and frankly, I don't think they did much more than lose money.
What was her name as an actress?
As an actress, she was called Sarah Erskine.
Sila.
Sarah.
Oh,
Not Sarah, but Sarah, S-A-R-A-H. She did appear in Equity and in Spotlight, the directory of actors and actresses, but I don't think she was ever really well known, apart from this one success with Godfrey Terrell.
Right, so now it's the war, and you're going into the territorials.
Well, I just joined the territorials, and again, they couldn't accommodate us all, so I was released from my obligations, although still remaining a fusilier, and joined what was then just forming a thing known as the Local Defence Volunteers, which subsequently became the Home Guard. My father, who had served in the First World War in India in the Sindh Volunteer Rifles, had been made a captain of a local group of Local Defence Volunteers, and I went along to help him out, and having had experience of weapons in the OTC at Radley. I became his armourer, so-called. At least I called myself his armourer. And we were eventually issued with a lot of P4 rifles from Canada, absolutely preserved in Greece. And my first job was to degrease all these rifles. And then I was mounted guard in Dean's Yard in Westminster. And I remember one famous evening when the guard mounted and they had these P4 rifles and ammunition. And one of them let off his rifle in Dean's Yard under the arch there, just as we were mounting guard. And I can't say I hit the floor faster than that occasion. It was really quite interesting. Another episode during that period was when we mounted guard in Parliament Square with under the watchful eye of some guardsmen who mounted guard with us. I'm afraid I can't remember which regiment of guards it was, but anyway, we mounted guard, and it was a bitterly cold night, and all the uniform that the LDP were issued with was a light denim khaki, whereas the rail soldiers, of course, had serge, and we rather suffered. And the only interesting episode there, I think, was the ladies of the night who came to try and join us, but we resisted that particular temptation.
If people laugh today, don't they, at Dad's Army, the Home Guard? But I expect, you know, when you joined, it was a very serious situation.
It was a serious situation. We certainly took our military duties seriously. We drilled. We didn't do much more than plan to defend strong points in and around London. There wasn't very much else one the Home Guard in that particular part of the country could do. Eventually, my father's company had the privilege of mounting guard at Buckingham Palace, which was quite exceptional, I think. And in one particular raid, in which my father performed fairly successfully, he was awarded a military MBE for his services.
Yes, that must have been something, you know, to have been a guard there, I would
think. Yes, I think it was.
Yes.
I was away, of course. I didn't, by that time, I didn't have any contact with him after a fairly short space of time, because having joined the Royal Fusiliers in 1939, the following year, almost exactly a year later, I was called to go to the Essex Regiment for training at Brentford Barracks in Essex. Now, this was interesting because those barracks had been built, I think, originally for the East India Company, and I doubt they've been improved and modernised since then. We certainly had no indoor running water, and what running water we had was cold on outside, and very cold indeed in the wintertime, when we used to have to scrub the barrack room tables and outside in the cold. It was quite toughening. However, I joined with a group of people, I would think probably all, mostly, like myself, potential officers who joined up with a view to getting commissions. There were one or two old soldiers recalled from the reserve who came with us into the platoon. And this was my first experience of living in a barrack room. To begin with, we weren't in one of the old barrack rooms, but in a modern wartime hut, where we slept on beds made of three planks, put upon low trestles, already about 8 and 10 inches off the ground. And we were given three, what we call biscuits, I suppose, I might call them palliasses, which went on top, and we learnt to stack our kit on top of that. And every Saturday there used to be a kit inspection, which is a very careful inspection by the officers and very punishing for those of us who had to lay out our kit properly. In fact, having been a natural scrounger all my life, I acquired 2.5 kits. One to keep only for kit inspection, one for use, and half to lend to other people who'd lost their bits and pieces. Another little scrounge that I had was came when we were issued with kit bags, and had to put the names of individuals on the kit bags as stencils. I got myself this job, and one of my colleagues at that time was an awfully nice man called Robin Schlafly. And I see from book lists that he's since written a book about Burma, though I haven't read it, and I must get hold of it one of these days. However, when it came to Schlafly, kit bag, I stenciled S-C-H-L-A umlaut F-L-I, which didn't please him very much because he spelled it with an E and not an umlaut. Oh, that passed off. And this wonderful sergeant we had was a reservist. He'd been working on the roads, I think, after he'd been released from the army and came called back. And he's a superman, but he had awful difficulty in pronouncing words. And of course, Dmitri Ardi and Schlafly was completely beyond him. And we became Wheelbarrow 1 and Wheelbarrow 2. And I remember a wonderful lecture he was giving us on the anti-tank rifle when he said, I was always like the anti-tank rifle where the tanks can't negate. Well, having been there for a little while, most of the platoon, in fact all the platoon, were called up to be told that they were going off to Oktu. But Schlafly and I were told to stay behind, and we were told that we were not going to go. And on inquiry why not, we were told by the officer in charge of us that we had unfortunate names which had to be investigated. My father was absolutely furious. He'd served as an officer in the 1418 war. One of his brothers had been an officer in the 1418 war, and another of his brothers had been knighted for his services in the 1418 war. And he was offering a suit against the MOD, or I suppose it was the War Department in those days, for this. However, we got away with it. Before we got away, I was then made a Lance Corporal, which made me very pleased. And I was able to use the Corporal's Mess at Worley Barracks. By that time, we'd moved from the hut into the old Indian Army barracks, the cold ones. So we eventually got away to Oktu. And first we went to Droitwich. But before long, that Oktu was moved up to Malvern. And while at Malvern, we took it in turns to be acting platoon commander for a day, I think it was. I don't think it was longer than a day. And the occasion when it was my turn to be platoon commander, we were marching the platoon through what was called a spider, a sort of hut with legs sticking out all over it, and going through a door at the end to get out into the open. And I got to the back of this body I was controlling and got them along the passage and through the door where I saw an officer. So I saluted him, and he stopped me and said, why didn't you give me eyes right? So I said, well, you can see perfectly well that I couldn't do that because I was at the back of the platoon and they'd all gone past you before I came up with you. And he riled me, so I reported him. And as a result of that, I got promoted to company and passed out of Oktu a month before I would otherwise have done. But before I passed out, we had a drill competition amongst the various platoons. And having been in the Radley OTC, I had the benefit of having been accustomed to doing stick drill, that is to say, drilling with a swagger cane or stick of some sort. And so I was given the job of commanding them, our platoon, for this competition, which I'm glad to say we won. So there I was, passing out of Oktu.
What other training did you have? Did you have many lectures?
Oh, we had endless lectures. We had what they call toots, tactical exercises without toots, without troops, lectures of all sorts. We had to pass out in motorcycle riding. I already had a driving license, so I didn't have to pass out in driving vehicles. We also had lectures on how to behave in the mess. We had to give our own 5-minute lecturettes, as they called them, to see if we could instruct. I can't remember that we did much weapon training. We'd done that at before we came to Oktu. And in fact, I had the advantages at Radley. I'd learned all about rifles. And so I only had to learn the other weapons. And indeed, while I was in the LDV, we did some Bren gun training at Chelsea Barracks, at Birdcage Ward, with the guards. And so I was fairly well acquainted with weapon training. From Oktu and I passed out, we had to state what regiment we wished to go into. And that was a poser for me. I hadn't actually thought about it. But I don't know why, I decided I'd like to go into the intelligence corps. So I was sent off to Oxford to be interviewed, and they particularly at that time were looking for linguists. And I was passed in French, but ploughed in German, so I wasn't accepted by the intelligence corps, and I've never regretted it since. Because to those of us in the infantry, we rather rudely, and perhaps unfairly, used to describe their cap badge as a pansy resting on its laurels. So, what was I to do? I had, at that time, two cousins, they were brothers, who had joined the TA just before the war, and as they lived in Cheshire, they'd gone into the Royal Fusiliers. Their other brother went into the Cheshire Yeomanry. So I said, well, I'll join the Royal Fusiliers. If it's good enough for my cousins, it's good enough for me, and so I did. And the interesting thing is that the three of us, quite by chance, all eventually became adjutants of our respective battalions of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. And indeed, the elder one of the two, George, my cousin George, and I had very parallel careers, because I was in the 1st Battalion of the regiment, became adjutant and later DAQMG of the brigade. He was adjutant and then later DAQMG of the brigade, and eventually AAQMG with Joe Stillwell, the American Vinegar Joe. So I joined at Wrexham in the depot of the regiment. At that time, George had gone out to India to join the 2nd Battalion, who was still at Lucknow, and his brother Theodore had gone into one of the territorial battalions, and I think they were originally in Ireland, but later somewhere in England, and his path never crossed mine during the war, although his elder brother did, George. I spent some little time at Wrexham, where I learnt a bit more about the army. I went on a 3-inch mortar course. I was in charge of the battalion, the company's pay and so on. Marched them to the village church in Wrexham, where I've since been several times. There's duty officer in the barracks, which is now largely demolished, and in due course was posted to the 1st Battalion in Yorkshire. It was in the beginning of 1941 that I joined the 1st Battalion. They had come back, of course, from the BEF, where they had had extremely heavy casualties, and more so extremely heavy losses as prisoners of war. And they'd come back to reform in Yorkshire, where they started to collect reinforcements. A lot of them came from the Gloucestershire Regiment, I recall, and subsequently became very splendid Royal Welsh Fusiliers. I was attached to battalion headquarters, which is a little place called Norton Grove. I lived in a Nissen hut there with several other officers. Quite pleasant. But when the winter came, we had one of those stoves in the middle of the hut, which had been idle all summer, but filled up with rubbish. And so when it got cold, we decided to light the rubbish and have a fire. And as I was walking across the room of the Nissen hut, a terrific bang. Somebody obviously dropped a live round into the fire, and the casing came straight out and hit the little hole at the bottom, which we'd left up to cause the draft, and hit me in the leg. So that was my first wound, although I didn't count it as such. With the battalion, I was understudy to the intelligence officer, an awfully nice man called W. Rees, who was a very fine pianist, and we used to get him to play music in the mess and have a very good time with him. I was sent off from there on yet another mortar course to Netheravon. I don't know why they kept on picking on me for mortar courses. I never was, had anything to do with the mortars, having done all these courses, but I suppose that was the way the army worked. They had to find some, they were given a vacancy on the course, had to find somebody to put on it, and would pick up on whoever was most available to attend it. At that time, or before I got into the Nissen hut, rather, I was billeted in a house in Malton in Yorkshire. And we were due to go on an exercise up in, I think it was up to Otterburn. And being a green and an experienced chap, I said to the batman I'd be given, I don't bother to call, it's a very early start, I'll get up and you make your own way.